You are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com. You're listening to The Legal Help Desk with Salar Atrazadeh, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to The Legal Help Desk. As most listeners know, on this exclusive radio program, we talk about legal principles, recent cases, and updates. Today, my guest is Bob Zeidman. If time permits, we plan to talk about software forensics and intellectual property issues, such as software copyrights and protecting trade secrets. Please bear in mind that our discussions are for general purposes only and are not intended to create an attorney-client relationship. The law is complicated and you should consult with a qualified attorney before taking legal action. Please make sure you don't disclose confidential information during the program. You may call us on the air at 818-602-4929 for your questions. You should visit my law firm's website, atrazadeh.com, and click on podcast to listen to archived interviews. You can also download them through iTunes or stitcher.com under the news and politics category. Bob Zeidman is one of the leading experts on intellectual property, particularly as it relates to software. He is the president and founder of Zeidman Consulting, a premier contract research and development firm in Silicon Valley. His clients have included Apple Computer, Cisco Systems, Facebook, Intel, Symantec, Texas Instruments, and Zynga. He is also the president and founder of Software Analysis and Forensic Engineering Corporation, the leading provider of software and intellectual property analysis tools for forensic examinations. Bob is considered a pioneer in analyzing and synthesizing software source code. He has worked on and testified in over 125 cases. Mr. Zeidman is an instructor and a writer. His book, The Software Detective's Handbook, is the first comprehensive text on quantitative software forensics. He holds numerous patents. He has earned two bachelor's degrees in physics and electrical engineering from Cornell University, and a master's degree in electrical engineering from Stanford University. Bob, thank you for joining my radio program again. How are you?
Good. Thanks, Salar. It's really glad. Good to be here, and thank you for inviting me back.
My pleasure. And I heard you're in New York, so how's the weather out there?
Actually, the weather looks nice. Sunny and no snow, but I know the last time I was here, it looked that way until New York got one of its worst snowstorms and I was stranded here.
Yes, they've had a brutal winter season, and luckily out here in California, which you also reside, it hasn't been that way.
Yeah, you know, the storm here wasn't all bad. I had a forced vacation. I got to wander Times Square and see a Broadway show.
Well, that's always good.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen often, especially in your business.
Yeah.
So
it's usually hard to justify taking some time off to do that.
So. Absolutely. I think you know, what we plan to talk about today is crucial and very important for our listeners to know. I know a lot of the audience are involved in technology and software applications. I've spoken to some of the listeners and prospective clients about their questions regarding how to protect software, how to protect their ideas in the technology sector. So hopefully they will listen and learn and maybe be in touch with us later on for further questions or guidance.
Sure. So where would you like to start?
Well, I think we should talk about your book for a minute. Can you tell the audience more about your book? It's called The Software Detective's Handbook.
Sure. The full title is The Software IP Detective's Handbook. and something like measurement, comparison, and analysis of infringement.
Mm-hmm.
What I did was, and I think this goes to some of the subjects we'll be discussing today, is that there have often been a kind of a hodgepodge of techniques used to analyze software to determine copyright infringement and patent infringement and trade secret misappropriation. And over the years, I developed some algorithms for comparing software and some methodologies for looking at the software once those algorithms have been run on it. The algorithms give a quantitative measurement of how similar programs are and where those similarities are. And then I describe processes for using that information to determine copyright infringement or, in some cases, trade secret misappropriation.
Right.
And then the book expands on the legal, it talks about the legal aspects of intellectual property and infringement with respect to software, and is particularly useful for engineers who don't understand those concepts. It has a section on software that explains the basics of what is software to lawyers who may not have the background in that.
Right.
And then it's got a mathematical section that hopefully mathematicians and computer scientists will get something out of. It says, how do you apply these algorithms I've developed to determine whether infringement took place?
Okay. And for people, an audience who just tuned in, we have Bob Zeidman on the air. We're discussing his book called The Software IP Detective's Handbook. It can be found on Amazon.com. The price is approximately $36. And Mr. Zeidman is an expert in the field of IP protection and software forensics. Bob, do us a favor and break down the meaning of software copyright. What is it, and what is it useful for?
So software copyright, so, you know, I'll go back to what is copyright for. Certainly lay people who aren't lawyers, don't always understand that the whole point of intellectual property protection is to disseminate information so that others can learn from it. And copyright protection says that a specific expression of an idea can have a copyright so that somebody can put that idea out there, that expression of the idea,
right,
and protect it, not be afraid that at least for some period of time people will steal it directly, but rather people can learn from it, improve on it, create additions to it. So that was the idea behind copyrights on, let's say, novels, which most people are, I think, very comfortable with. You know, you can't copyright the idea of a boy and a girl from opposite sides of town falling in love and dying in the end. I hope I didn't give away the ending to Romeo and Juliet to anybody who hasn't read it yet.
Right.
But, you know, you can't copyright the idea of that, but you could copyright the specific words, wherefore art thou Romeo,
right,
and even the names Romeo and Juliet. And so you can have a copyright in that. And software is similar, although software copyright laws, I have to say, have some idiosyncrasies to them that are strange.
Yes.
And you and I were talking a little bit beforehand, and I think some of those idiosyncrasies are why there's some confusion about software copyright. And
yes,
I can talk about that if you like.
Please do. Please do. I think we have ample time to discuss these important concepts and theories.
Okay, so with software, you know, well, let me backtrack to when you copyright, first of all, you have a copyright when you've finished a work. Some people think you have to register it with the government to have a copyright, but that hasn't been true for a long time.
Right.
But you have a copyright, but the government encourages you to register it with them so they have a record so that if you go to court, you know, the government has a record that's official, that here's what you wrote,
right,
and that it belongs to you. With software, it's the same thing. You have a copyright once you've finished it, although I'm not sure, you know, this is one of the gray areas. How do you define when software is finished?
Right.
But, you know, disregarding that for now, the idea of a copy, when you copyright a novel, you submit the novel to the copyright office, the U.S. Copyright Office, and then if somebody needs to verify that you have a copyright, they can go get a copy that's been registered and verify it. With software, with the Software Copyright of 1980, which codified software copyright, software developers said, hey, we don't want people going in and getting our code because then they'll know all the trade secrets we have in it, all the things that are our secret recipes and algorithms and things that do what it does better than our competitors. So the Copyright Act of 1980 said that, okay, you can register software, but you only have to file the first 50 pages of code and the last 50 pages.
Right.
And that made sense, all kind of made sense, in the days when software was just one long string of code.
Correct.
Nowadays, you have web servers and web clients and object-oriented code and HTML and different languages, and the code is in modules. But you're still supposed to submit the first 50 and the last 50. So basically, you can pick what you consider to be the first 50 pages and the last 50 pages and submit them,
right,
and leave out everything in between, and therefore not give away your secrets. And in addition, you can redact in those 100 pages. I may have the numbers wrong. Maybe the first 25 and the last 25. I'd have to check. But in those pages, you can redact any information that contains trade secrets.
Right.
So, you know, I've been involved in cases where we go in to check the registered software, and it's basically a bunch of blank pages with maybe a few symbols or a few simple words, you know, and almost no identifying information. So,
that's right.
So, you know, that defeats the purpose a little bit, because the purpose was originally to make a copyrighted work public so that people could learn from it.
Right, refer to it and make sure that they're not infringing or violating that copyright.
Oh, and it's actually, I just looked it up here. It's the first 25 and the last 25, so 50 total pages.
Okay.
But right, so whereas you and I can read Romeo and Juliet and say, hey, this is a great book, but my idea is to use zombies instead of, you know, people, you know, a boy and a girl from a long time ago, that's fine to do. And in fact, I recommend seeing the movie Warm Bodies, which is exactly that. You know, but people can look at a software, copyrighted software, and understand how it works from looking at the code, because there's almost no code registered with the Copyright Office.
Right.
But on the other hand, for that reason, I also tell companies that I advise that they should register their copyrights of their software. It's also something like $35. You can register online, upload the pages online,
right,
pay $35, and then now you've got this great protection of your software. It doesn't protect the concept, it doesn't protect the algorithms, but it does protect the way you've implemented those algorithms so that your employees, for example, can't just quit and take the code with them and start a new company.
Right, and you and I spoke briefly about this before we got on the air, and I pulled up a website that's posted on Harvard University Office of Technology Development, and the article's title is Copywriting Software versus Patenting Software, and we talked about which route to take and which has, you know, advantages or disadvantages. And the article specifically says copyright protects an original work in the tangible fixed form in which it has been set down. So it protects only the expression of the work and not the idea underlying the work.
Right.
Right?
It's mostly, right, and that's mostly for protect. The situation that I see most often is an employee or programmer. Sometimes, be perfectly honest, they do this with some amount of innocence.
Right.
Because they think that, well, I'm just taking some code I wrote. I worked for company A, and I'm going to start my own company, or I'm going to work go to company B, mm-hmm. and hey, I've already got this code they can use, so I'll bring it with me, not realizing that code is pretty valuable stuff.
It
and
is.
Taking it with them is copyright infringement.
Could be. And the primary purpose of copyright is to promote the exchange of information and advancement of ideas. But, you know, it's not the only way to protect ideas, for example, copyrights. And I think patenting, if possible, and again, you have to go through the hoops and hurdles associated with the USPTO's application process, but if you can patent and copyright the software, wouldn't that be an extra layer of protection?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely an extra layer, and I recommend strongly to clients of mine that they do the patent. Now, with the patent, they are releasing not necessarily code, but they are describing in detail how their algorithms work, mm-hmm. how their software works. And the whole idea, again, of a patent, which really does accomplish what it's supposed to, is to say, okay, we're going to protect this way of doing something, but we're going to show the whole world how to do it, and I could, you know, anybody can go to the patent office, look and see how, you know, Amazon does their one-click patent, for example, and say, okay, here's how they do it. Let's see how we can improve on that.
Right.
And that's the whole idea of, people forget that the idea of patents is to give people protection while they share their ideas so that other people can improve on them.
Yes, that's an important notation. And I think going back to the website on Harvard University, it talks about some case law, and I'll briefly talk about that, but it basically says that a patent owner has a right to keep others from making, selling, or using a patented invention for 20 years from the filing date of the patent application. So the courts have dealt with this topic specifically on numerous occasions, going back to 1931, where the Supreme Court rendered its decision that laws of science and nature are unpatentable. Mathematical algorithms, formulas, and equations were believed to fall under this category. Then in 1946, a case called Gottschalk versus Benson, an algorithm was rendered unpatentable, but only because there was no particular application defined for the algorithm. And again in 1981, in Diamond versus Deere, the process claim for operating machinery using a computer was upheld as patentable. And for further clarification on this specific matter, the USPTO, the United States Patent and Trademark Office, in 1989, provided clarification saying that it's published guidelines for software patenting, highlighting that a computer directed by a computer program is a statutory machine. Do you know what that means, a statutory machine?
Well, I have an idea, but the courts keep changing the definitions. One thing that's happened in recent years that I've heard a lot of attorneys complaining about is that because there have been more and more patent cases, more and more of them have been going to the Supreme Court, who, if you look at the resumes of the Supreme Court justices, they've never worked on patent cases other than the ones that come to them at the Supreme Court.
Right.
And it's been very frustrating to a lot of people where courts every year, particularly with software patents, some of the terminology and the definitions will change. So I know that at one point, it was said that, as you pointed out, algorithms themselves were not patentable, but some court decided that if the algorithm is implemented by a machine, mm-hmm. then it's patentable. So people started saying,
I think we have a caller. Give me a second. Hold on 1 second.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Hello. You're on the legal help desk. How are you?
Good. You're also.
How can we help you? Do you have a question for us or any comments?
I do have a question, actually.
Go ahead, please.
Can I just fire it off?
Yeah, go ahead, please. We have Bob Zeidman on the air. He can listen to your question and answer it.
All right, cool. Hey. I'm not too big into code myself. I was listening to the show earlier, and you're talking about how you can protect your apps. I'm actually not a big coder, as I said, but I do have people under me who that's their expertise. Right. How do you know, or how can you protect yourself from infringing on someone else's, patent or copyright? Is there a way to, is there something you can line it up against? You said the first 25, the last 25 pages. If you submit that, whoever you submit it to, do they send a flag to you telling you, you're already in the law?
Did you hear that question, Bob? Because I think we're having a little difficulty hearing you, if you don't mind speaking up again. But, Bob, did you hear the question?
Yeah, I did hear the question. It's actually a very good question. So let me break it into two parts, the copyright and the patent infringement issue. One thing with copyright is when you submit a copyright registration to the Copyright Office, they do no checking whatsoever. That's why it's $35. $35 covers putting it in a database, and that's it. So in fact, two people can register the same copyright. They shouldn't be able to, ideally. But two people could register the same code, and they'd both get a copyright on it. It would only come out in court. But then, in court, if there's a litigation, they could both go to the Copyright Office, and at least one piece of evidence, not by any means all the evidence, but one piece would be who registered it first.
Right.
Now, having said that, I've seen companies where the stolen code was registered first because the original company didn't even think to register the copyright. But now, the way to copyright infringement is different than patent infringement, and you never need to check on copyright infringement if you've done everything else correctly. And by that I mean, if you think about the fact that nobody could steal Romeo and Juliet or copy it without having read it. So, at your company or whoever's, among the people who are developing code, you need to make sure that nobody, you basically need to trust the people and also have procedures in place to make sure that they are not bringing in code from any place else. That's basically what you need to do. If they're not bringing in code, they can say, I wrote this great code at my last company, and I'm going to remember how I did it and write it completely from scratch without looking at the old code. As far as copyright goes, that should be okay, because they're going to write completely different code. Now, there may be an issue with trade secrets theft. We haven't talked about trade secrets, but trade secrets are things that one company knows, and they've told their employees, don't tell anybody this. But that's a separate issue. Let's hold off on that for now. So, nobody's going to copy Romeo and Juliet without having a copy in front of them. Unless they have an eidetic memory where they can, picture it in their head word for word. And the same thing with code. If you've taken reasonable measures to make sure people aren't bringing in any code from anywhere else, then you shouldn't have a problem with copyright infringement.
I'm now, just showing myself up.
What's that?
I haven't even thought of that, actually.
Yeah, but it is important to make sure, and to protect a company, you should make sure that you have written procedures in place that employees sign that just says, I own the rights to anything. First of all, the company should own the rights to anything they produce, typically, and, say that they're not bringing in code from anywhere else. Look, I can tell you that I've worked on cases where companies brought me in as a consultant, and they were accused of copyright infringement. And they said, we don't copy, we just don't do it, it's against our policies, we talk to employees. And, in at least one or more cases, I've gone back to them and said, well, despite everything you did, one of your employees took in some code and copied it. But, there's not a lot you can do to protect yourself against that. What you can do is, I'll put in a plug, my company can be hired to do regular checks, and we can give you some advice on how to set up the procedures, but the fact is, if somebody wants to do that, there's virtually no way to stop them, and it's very difficult to discover until there's a lawsuit.
Wow.
But not to scare you, if the best thing is, the lawsuits don't happen very often. Most people are honest, If you have procedures in place, it limits that. And if you go into a lawsuit and you find that you did copy, you know, one of your employees did copy something, the best thing to do is discover it quickly. You know, my company has tools that can discover that very quickly, and our expertise, we can discover very quickly and tell the clients, and they can do at least as much as they can to minimize the damage.
Right. And if I may add to that, you should have contracts in place, enforceable agreements between the company and the employees, whether or not they're W-2 versus independent contractors, that sets out the guidelines towards providing work, providing services or goods to the company, who owns the license or the actual work, what can or cannot be done with that, and basically protecting the owner of the software from the outset.
Yeah, and I think that's where somebody like Salar can help you. You know, I can tell you what ought to be in there, and he can write up the contracts with all the legal details that I'm not familiar with.
That's correct.
With patents, it's different. If you want me to, I can move on to patents if you like.
Sure. I just have one more question, just a quick one.
Go ahead.
Programmers, coders, is there some sort of official rule where they know not to bring existing code back with them? Or is that something that anybody could completely just, you know, not realizing do by accident?
So that's a really good question. And the answer is that, unfortunately, there's no code of ethics that, you know, universal code of ethics. And what's worse is there's a growing open source movement, which I think is terrific. These are people who love to share code among each other. You know, they write code with the intent of sharing it. Unfortunately, there are a lot of extremists in that movement who believe that all code should be shared. And programmers coming out of school are hearing a lot more from those people than they are from people like me who say, you know, code is, you spend a lot of time writing your code. This is valuable stuff. You know, you can give it away if you want to, but you don't have to. And you can only take it from people who have given you permission to take it. But there's a lot of misunderstanding, and people have this really complete misunderstanding a lot of times, engineers do, that, hey, you know, code, if it's not free, it should be free, and therefore I should be able to take it. So we're seeing a lot more copyright infringement these days from programmers who have learned that programming should be free, and therefore they're going to, you know, if programming should be free, it's okay for them to give away their code, their own personal code that they own, but it's not good for them to give away the company's code or to take code from somebody who hasn't agreed to give it away.
Well, thank you.
So I would say, you know, talk to these programmers, and that's why having them sign something or read and acknowledge something that says, we understand that what we're doing is valuable to ourselves, to the company, and, you know, other people's code is valuable to them. We won't give away ours or take theirs unless we have permission from them to do that.
I'll definitely have a meeting. Yeah.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you for your support. I hope we answered your questions.
There was a part about, I can also talk about a little bit about patents if you like. So, Laura, do you want me to?
Yes. I think we've answered the caller's questions. So.
Okay.
He can, if he likes, he can stick around, or he can hang up the phone. It's up to him. But we can proceed to patents. That's fine.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day. All right. So, yes, I think we should talk about patents because it's imperative, again, for people to know the options and what option provides, you know, what level of protection. And that's the whole goal and objective of this specific discussion today.
And I think that there's people should, what they really want to consider, I believe, is the choice between trade secrets and patents. Mm-hmm. And I can talk about some of those trade-offs.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, so, you know, a patent is a very valuable thing. I have some personal stories, but you can read my book or you know, I can summarize them a little later if you want. But I've, when I was younger and naive about patents, I didn't patent my software thinking, oh, this is obvious. Programmers have, maybe many inventors have this idea that, well, if I thought of it, it must be pretty obvious.
Right.
But the inventor always thinks that way because it was very clear to the inventor but not to everybody else. And that holds true for software. And so I recommend to companies that they patent a lot of stuff, especially young companies. They file patents, they protect their, because the patents protect not just specific code, but higher level implementations of various algorithms. You know, how do you, how do you do whatever it is that you're doing that gives your software an advantage over everybody else?
Right.
It's a long process, a little bit expensive, and then the risk that you're taking is that it goes public. By definition, the patent office will, you know, they will verify that you've got a good patent that nobody else has, a good invention.
Right.
That's why it costs so much, because they'll argue with you and tell you you're wrong, and you have to argue back with them and change things, and eventually, if it works out, you get your patent. And that means nobody else can do it in the same way that you have, but they can do it in a different way.
Right.
Sometimes people forget that. But it gets published typically after a year and a half, it gets published, and you can go to the Patent Office website and see all the patents and the applications that have not been allowed yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is a bit of a risk that says, what if our invention, our software, is so good that our competitors, they'll see it on the patent site and they will copy it, you know, not copy the code, but write their own code to do the same thing. And, you know, we may never get the patent, but we've showed them in detail how our code works.
Right, right. And I think a famous case called Freeman Walter Abel, it's In Re Abel, that's a USPTO case. The patent protection was denied, for example, because of the inventions in the form of certain algorithms and inventions relating to methods of doing business.
Oh, right.
That was, a 1982 case. And then at some point, the patent office drafted new guidelines. And one was first to determine whether or not an invention is useful in the technological arts, having a real-world, quote-unquote, value, and not a mere concept. Within that framework, methods of doing business should be treated like any other process. But there is that battle of how do we patent a software? Does it fall under the category of inventions, or is it something related to compilations or arrangements of non-functional information or some kind of machine-readable storage medium. These are different, I guess, ideas that the Patent Office is struggling with. Am I correct?
Yeah, the Patent Office, not just the Patent Office, but the courts. And what's frustrating for someone like me as an inventor and someone who works as an expert witness on patent cases,
right,
is that the courts keep making changes to what's allowed and what's not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the changes only require the patentee to write different words in the patent claims.
Right.
But other than that, everything's the same.
Well,
you know, part...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, part of the problem, I think,
mm-hmm,
is that, you know, years ago, to be an inventor, you had to have equipment and, you know, at least you had to understand how equipment worked and build something. You didn't have to build it, but you at least had to describe how it was built.
Right.
So, you know, most people did not have the kind of tools to invent something, although you still had, I point out to people, you still had things like the paperclip. There were, you can look up, and I think there are hundreds of patents on the paperclip. Which was not a complex device, and anybody could think of a new way of doing it. But people knew a paperclip was something you could touch and look at, and you could describe the tools to bend it into shape, for example.
Mm-hmm.
With software has, it's this great technological achievement where you can describe just a process for doing something, and then it becomes a program that actually does it.
Right.
You know, never before in history could you think of something and then, you know, write down some instructions for doing it, and that would do it.
Exactly. Precisely.
So
that's a good point.
Yeah, and so people are having a hard time. I mean, I think software is always, it's something that, it's basically a method patent. Methods have been patentable for ever since the patent system was invented. Mm-hmm. But it's never been so easy, which also explains why there's, you know, with the because software is so easy, and with the advent of the internet, it explains why everybody and anybody can have a patent, a software patent. And a lot of people who protest software patents think this is a bad thing. But in my mind, we've turned all of society into potential inventors, and I think that's a good thing. You don't have to have a lot of money
right.
and equipment to invent something.
Yes, yes, and that's a good point. Folks, if you just tuned in to the Legal Help Desk, we have Bob Zeidman on the air, president and founder of Zeidman Consulting. His office is located at 15565 Swiss Creek Lane in Cupertino, California. His telephone number is 408-741-5809. Bob, that's a fantastic and remarkable point that you just made. I think, you know, with the advent of technology, and we've had software programs for some time now, but internet is relatively newer, a lot of things have changed, including the distribution and creation of apps, the applications that people install on their iPhones or smartphones that allow them to do stuff. Those have also been an issue and some kind of predicament for the courts and also the patent office, haven't they?
Yeah, they definitely have. But I think if you look at it the way we're looking at it, it's a positive thing that now any high school student can write an app mm-hmm. and put it on, you know, one of the app stores, Android or Apple,
right?
And be very successful at it, whether that's making a lot of money or creating something that millions of people use. And all these people, part of that success is they want to protect their ideas, because once you put an idea out there, any person or company with more money than you can take your idea and do the same thing. And a patent is a way of protecting that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think that's why we've got so many patent applications and so many are for software, because there's just so much more software out there and anybody in their house. You know, when I was younger, my high school had a terminal to an HP computer.
Right.
And that was rare. We had to fight. We had to fight over the use of that one terminal. And now, you know, people have multiple computers, their smartphones, their home computers.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what we're doing here is fantastic. And like you said, the technology kicking in and merging with software and the internet is creating this new movement, the technological movement, if you will. And how do the courts deal with it? How do the inventors / patent owners deal with it? And also the USPTO is an ongoing, battle, if you want to call it that, or some kind of movement. Your job, obviously, is to decipher who took the other person's idea and how and when. You have the tools and resources. My job is to protect and prevent and sometimes enforce someone's rights. And, you know, it's quite an interesting paradigm, don't you think?
Yeah, it is, and there's a lot of issues, a lot of people passionate about patents, either wanting to strengthen them or strengthen the laws or weaken the laws. It's a really hot topic with us. You know, people are all familiar with the big patent cases going on. They may not be familiar with some of the smaller patent cases going on, but there's certainly a lot of, you know, a lot of interest in this. And when you're developing technology this quickly, mm-hmm. and we have communication systems that allow you to transport whole ideas across the world virtually instantly, we've got issues with patents and patent infringement that we haven't ever seen before, and copyright infringement.
That's right. And as you know, copyright law is pursuant to federal law, Title 17 U.S. Code, Sections 101, and also the Patent Act is Title 35 U.S. Code, Sections 101 et sec. I think if I was looking at this interview and I was listening to it, and if I was planning or am planning or doing some kind of work related to softwares, my question to you would be, where do I start off? What is the outline or the bullet points that I need to go through in order to do things right? Basically, get off on the right foot before it's too late. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Is there a way, is there something you can just think of and say, you know, first, obviously, maybe copyright, try to register that. Second, you know, do X. Third, do Y. And so on. Do you have something like that that you can share with the audience today?
Sure. You know, it's a good idea for a nice chapter, perhaps, in the next edition of my book. You know, what I recommend to companies, I'm working with a bunch of startups, and I say, first, copyright all your code. It's so cheap and no risk that there's no reason not to.
Right.
And there are benefits you know, that I've discussed, other benefits I haven't yet discussed, but it's just worthwhile doing. The second thing is, look at everything in your code that you think was either difficult to do, or even if it was easy to do, something that nobody else has, you know, that your competitors don't have, or something that just makes your software unique.
Right.
Then divide those up and say, which ones are we okay making public in order to get protection from the government? And those things would be patentable. In other words, we're okay if our competitors know this as long as the government protects us against them stealing it, because that's only going to be, the government protection, the patent only lasts for 17 to 20 years. And if this is something you think is going to be worthwhile for 100 years, maybe a patent isn't the right thing for it. So the things that you want to keep absolutely secret, those are trade secrets that you don't want to patent, but you want to make sure you've got all the legal paperwork in place. You've got security systems and paperwork. Your employees sign contracts that say this stuff is secret and you won't tell anybody. You know, and basically, if you did, there will be consequences. And then I'd say of the things that you want to patent, you've obviously got a budget, and you've got to decide which things to actually patent,
right,
depending on your budget. And one thing I want to remind, especially startup companies, you know, the gentleman before the caller, I think he said something about protecting your patents. You know, the biggest thing about protecting your own intellectual property from other people is to have your own patents, or to protect yourself from accidentally infringing on someone's patents, mm-hmm, which you don't want to do. You want to try not to, but the fact is, sometimes it happens because you happen to think of some great idea that somebody already has a patent on. The best defense in that case is to have your own patents. So when people come after you and say, hey, you infringed on our patent, and you know, you didn't mean to do that, it just happened, but you've got your own patent, you say, well, you know, look, you're infringing on our patents, and then you can reach a settlement. But if you don't have any of your own patents, then you're in trouble because you don't have any counterclaims against the other party.
Okay, all right. That's a start. That's certainly a start, and I think it gives the listeners an idea of which direction to take, which steps and procedures are relatively imperative and important. And again, for, you know, legal protection, the prospective clients, the audience, the listeners should go and speak with a qualified attorney.
Right. I want to emphasize that, too, that they should speak to someone like you. You know, I give general advice, but, you know, the specifics come down to what the law is about at that specific time and the specific situations of each company.
Right. So going back to what you said, how do or does someone decide between getting a patent of or keeping a trademark on the software?
Oh, a trade secret.
Trade secret, yes.
Yeah, the it's really a that it's difficult to give many guidelines on that, except that, first of all, the budget, you know, every company is going to have a limited budget on patents, and patents can become expensive. So, you know, whatever you don't patent will become your trade secret. You'll just never tell anybody about it.
Right.
But also there are cases where, you know, basically where you don't want something to become public at all. I'll give you an example. At my company, my software company, we were considering having a method of finding copied code where we would modify somebody's code. We'd have a tool that would modify code before it was shipped. And if somebody copied it, we could find those modifications.
Oh, I see, I see.
And now, what we didn't want to do is we didn't want to patent that, because if we patented it, it would tell people how that worked, and then they could defeat the, they could find, you know, what we'd inserted into the code, for example, or how we'd modified the code,
right,
and change it. They'd be able to defeat the mechanism if they knew how it worked. So we said, let's not patent this.
Right.
Because we don't want anyone to know how it works.
Right. In other words, they would circumvent that that system or that method.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So in fact, that's a clue that anything having to do with security is often a trade secret rather than a patent.
Okay. All right. You mentioned a couple of things that I think are important for the listeners to know about. A couple of cases that you outlined for me. One is called the case of the overconfident defendant. What is that all about?
So, yeah, there are stories I like to tell about different cases where I don't, you know, I don't talk about the details of the client names, but I just think they're interesting. So I work, my company does expert witness work, and these are some of the more interesting ones. The overconfident defendant. So I've developed tools for finding copyright infringement. It's a tool that you plug both sets of software into the tool, and the tool comes up with some measurements, and it points to sections of code, and it says, this looks like it may have been copied. And then we go through a process to see, has this actually been copied or not?
Right.
And it's very extensive. And early on, when I first developed this tool, and not many people knew about it, I was asked to be an expert on a case for a plaintiff in a copyright infringement case. And the defendants were some programmers who worked for a company and then went off and started their own competing company. And the parties agreed that I could run a comparison on the two sets of code at the law firm for the defendants. And the defendants were a bunch of young people, you know, young programmers and very confident in themselves. And they kept saying, well, you know, we didn't copy. We just didn't do it. There's nothing in there. You know, sure, you can go ahead and look at it, but you've only got a day to look at it, you know, because, you know, we can't afford to give you our code for longer than a day. And I think they thought that, you know, nobody could find, if they're, well, looking back, I think they thought they had covered their tracks, and anyway, a day wasn't enough time
right.
to look at the code, because most people did it manually. So I ran my tools, and, you know, before the day was over, it popped up something really interesting. So these people were basically challenging us, like, you know, basically saying, oh, there's nothing in there, right. you won't find any copying, we did everything right, we would never copy. Well, the interesting thing is they actually had done, they had gone through the code and made a whole bunch of changes to it so that normally I couldn't find the copying.
Right.
But my code match program found something really interesting. We looked not just at the code, but I had it look at the installer, which is a program that installs the code on your computer.
Exactly, the executable.
Right, right. And interestingly enough, it was a Windows program, and anyone who knows Windows, when you install a program, you put you set up the registry, the Windows registry, with information about the program.
Right, right.
And one of those pieces of information was the name of the company that program belong to.
Oh, boy. Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, exactly. So although they had done a good job of covering everything else up, they left this out. When you, in the installer, it actually installed it with the name of the company was my client, not their company.
Oh, goodness.
That was a pretty strong clue that they had copied. And once you find a clue like that, then you start going through the rest of it. And other things that might seem like coincidence, you know, suddenly don't seem like coincidence anymore.
You know, that's just a fantastic example of how the case can fall apart for the defendant or the other side when there's this irrefutable, clear and convincing, you know, piece of evidence that you can just wave in the jury's face or the judge's face and say, Your Honor, you know, look at this. This is what happened, and there's no way for them to deny the accuracy or the veracity of this, you know, piece of document. So I'm sure your client was very, very content.
Yeah. I can tell you that when we work for plaintiffs, if there is copying, we find it. You know, and by the way, anybody can license our tools from us. But the other thing is, when we work for defendants, if we can clear a defendant by looking at doing a complete comparison, there has never been a case where we've cleared a defendant and somebody's found something we didn't find. So it's also a very good tool for a defendant to absolutely show that there's no copying.
Folks, we had Bob Zeidman on the air. Bob is an expert in the field of intellectual property, particularly as it relates to software. He's the president and founder of Zeidman Consulting in the Silicon Valley area. And Bob is located in, is it the city of Cupertino?
Yep, Cupertino. It's the home of Apple Computer.
Yes. I think I've seen it on the map.
Yeah, Apple put it on the map, and people would tell me that they've heard of it only because when they bought a new iPhone, it was set to show weather in Cupertino.
That's correct. And Bob's email is bob@zeidmanconsulting.com. His book called The Software IP Detective's Handbook, Measurement, Comparison, and Infringement Detection can be found on Amazon.com. I think the price is $36 paperback and $22.99 on Kindle. At least that's what it says on Amazon. So if you get a chance, look at the book, buy it, and hopefully we'll have Mr. Zeidman back on the program for additional interviews and discussions. Bob, thank you so much for being on my program. Thank you for your support. I really look forward to having you back on the air with me.
Thanks, Salar. It's always a pleasure. I really enjoy this, so I look forward to coming back.
Okay, and stay safe and warm in New York.
Yeah, so far so good. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
Okay, bye. Bye.
I can tell you what I'll do.